The Destiny Foundation presents Rabbi Beryl Wein's Travels Through Jewish History. This, the 110th tape in the series, is entitled Jeremiah, delivered in 1988. We hope you enjoy.
Tonight's lecture is regarding the Novi Yirmiyahu, one of the most complex and sad figures in all of human history. And in many respects, he epitomizes, he's the quintessential Jew, because he carries with him that terrible tragedy, and yet he also is the author of some of the greatest and most beautiful lines of hope that exist in the Tanakh. And he is a very complicated situation, as Chazal describe it. Yirmiyahu comes after the terrible failure of Menashe. It seems to be always that when the opportunity for real greatness and real achievement is present, and if somehow that opportunity is aborted, so then what follows is not a placid period of mediocrity, but what follows thereafter is a disaster. And that's what makes the loss of the opportunity that much more painful. Generally speaking, in Jewish history, we can say it's all or nothing. There's very little middle ground. And that's what happens here. Now, since Chizkiyahu could have been the Mashiach, and the Novi Yeshayahu, together with him, was able to establish the Jewish people really at its highest level, since the time of Shlomo, and when it all falls apart, when Chizkiyahu, for his reasons, refuses to assume the mantle that could have led him to be the Mashiach, and Menashe, his son, in his 55-year reign, reverses almost all the good that his father did, the kingdom of Judah now begins a slide that's irreversible. A slide that will eventually, in the year 586, lead to its destruction, to the burning of the temple, the sacking of Jerusalem, and the taking of the Jewish people into the exile in Bavel. After Menashe, he has a descendant, Yoshiyahu, who is really the last great king of Judah. And Yoshiyahu restores the Jewish kingdom again to greatness, in terms of its spiritual strength. And the Tanakh says that there never arose anyone like the King Yoshiyahu who returned to God in the same fervor and in the same fashion that he did. So once again, we have a continuity in the pattern that has been outlined here. Kings do good, so their descendants do bad. They undo the good, and then their descendants in turn revert back to do good and undo the bad. The net result is zero. The net result is, in fact, the net result is a minus, because all of this takes a great deal out of the people. And you're never able to have a cumulative force for good, which is also a terrible thing. Most things in life which are achieved by cumulative forces. If you're able to put a winning streak together, it has a much stronger momentum than, you win one and you lose one and then you win one and then you lose one. So you end up exhausted and nowhere. Whereas if you could put a number of good things together, so then there's a real momentum of accomplishment and strength. That's what's lacking in the kingdom of Judah. If you could have put all the good kings together in one time, then none of the bad kings would have arisen. Because the people would have been at such a level, and the monarchy would have been at such a level, that it could not have been undone in one generation. But because of the fact that there is really no long period of accomplishment, so therefore, anyone who comes thereafter can undo it very easily. Yoshiyahu was a great king, but he went on an ill-advised war with Egypt, and he was killed. in the war. He went against the advice of the Navi, as I'll talk about in a few moments. And with him really lies buried the hopes of the Jewish people of the first Commonwealth, because his successors already are just the caretakers till the Churban. Yirmiyahu, according to the Medrash, was born on the ninth day of Av. And our rabbis said that that is part of the meaning that Yirmiyahu says in his prophecy. He says, Orur hayom asher yoladeti bo, cursed be the day that I was born. So the simple interpretation is that he bemoans his fate. But a rabbi saw in it a deeper meaning. That day, that's the bad day on the Jewish calendar, because so many terrible things have occurred to us over the ages on that day. Yirmiyahu was a Kohen. He was from the city of Anosos, Anatot, which is north of Yerushalayim. And it was in the hill country of Benjamin, the tribe of Binyamin. And what's in a name? Chazal saw that Yirmiyahu means from Yorim Yodo, that God raises his hand against the Jewish people. God's hand is raised against the Jewish people. Raised against the Jewish people, when God raises his hand, it's always in a threatening gesture. It's always in a gesture of punishment. There is the raising of hands for a blessing. And there is a raising of hands. So here Yirmiyahu is really the paradox of the matter, because Yirmiyahu, as being a Kohen, always raised his hands in blessing. And yet his name is because of the fact that the hand was raised in anger, in punishment, in destruction of the Jewish people. Just as an aside, by the way, the Gaon of Vilna says that the custom to bless one's children or any child by placing hands upon the child. So the Gaon says that one should only place one hand on the child, the right hand, because only the Kohanim have the right to bless with both hands. So that if one is not a Kohen, then the one should bestow the blessing only with one hand. It's written in the books that that was his custom his entire life. So Yirmiyahu his name over the fact that he is raising God's, he is testifying to the fact that God's hand is raised against the Jewish people. Also, our rabbi said that he's called Yirmiyahu because of the fact that measure of judgment, the Midas Hadin of God, was raised against the Jewish people. He lives to see what no one else wanted to see. Everybody knows it's going to happen. Everybody knows that it's coming, but nobody wants to see it. And it is one thing to know something vicariously. It is another thing to have to experience it, to be part of it. And there are many times that people run away from a disaster, and it's understandable. They know what's going to happen. They want to be there when the lock is put on the door. But Yirmiyahu is there. He is there to experience it. And in that tragedy is the really the summation of his personality. The Zohar says, again, what's in a name? So the Zohar says that's because that since he was going to be the prophet who was going to witness the destruction, therefore that's why he was called Yirmiyahu. It's very interesting that the English word Jeremiah, which means an elegy, a terrible poem or story or description of tragedy. So we say it because it's named after the prophet Jeremiah. That's how the English word came. But the name Jeremiah itself came because of the tragedy. So in effect, the word is a very good word. because its original source, its original intention is that it describes a scene of terrible tragedy. Yirmiyahu is descended from Rochav Hazona, one of the also strange stories in the Tanakh. The Tanakh is full of stories that we find hard to interpret, so therefore the way to treat all the stories is to ignore them, because since I don't know what to do with it. I was once at an educators' convention, I don't want to say, but one of the questions was asked to a very leading educator here, a Jewish educator, Torah educator. See that, how do you teach Shimshon, the story of Shimshon in school? So to which he replied, we don't. And we have a habit of avoiding the issues. Rochav was the woman who hid the spies, who hid Kolev and Pinchas at the time of the invasion of the land of Israel by Yoshua, and according to our rabbis, Yoshua later married her. Even though she was not Jewish originally, she converted. And Yirmiyahu was somehow descended. Through his mother, he was descended from Rochav. And that was one of the accusations that we'll see that the Jewish people cast up. Yirmiyahu is a terribly unpopular figure. Nobody likes a prophet anyway. But a prophet of only doom, you know, that's guaranteed bad news. No one is going to like him. And therefore, they look to find whatever defects, chinks in the armor that they could. And therefore, they said all sorts of terrible things about him. He stems from Rochav, and that's why he doesn't have a good eye for the Jewish people. He doesn't want to be a nice guy. He really doesn't like Jews. He's lacking in Ahavas Yisrael. He's lacking in love for the Jewish people. And all sorts of other things were brought up to him. But he sees the scene very clearly. He sees that the Jewish people are a small, defenseless country, the Kingdom of Judah. You have the major empire of Bovel to the north, which is getting stronger and stronger. It swallowed up Ashur. It swallowed up Aram. It swallowed up Gilad and Moab. So that you now have, for the first time, an empire which is a world empire. It's not just a local empire. It's a world empire. And to the south, the only nation that was possible, that it is possible to stand in, there's a buffer against Bovel, is Egypt. Egypt, even though it has alliances with the Jewish people, has little love for the Jewish people. And when the King Yoshio goes to war against Egypt and takes he makes the error of thinking that now is the time that he can gain an advantage, and he is killed, the Egyptians, even though they pay lip service to the treaty that they have with Judah to come and defend Judah against Nebuchadnezzar, and even though it's in their interest to do so, they will not do so. The Navi knows they will not do so. Deep down in their hearts, the Jewish people also know they will not do so. It's a little like the peace treaty with Egypt, which is a cold peace, right? To put it mildly, it's a cold peace. Deep down in our hearts, we're not too sanguine about it. We're not too certain how reliable that is. Well, it's the same situation here. They had a peace treaty with Egypt. Not only a peace treaty with Egypt, they had an alliance with Egypt. And under the terms of the alliance, Egypt was duty-bound to come and to come to the aid of Jerusalem in the event of an onslaught of the Babylonian army. Well, the onslaught came, the siege came, and Egypt never showed up. That did not save Egypt later from being destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar itself. But that was of little aid and of little comfort and really of no consequence to the Jewish people who are being destroyed. Yirmiyahu sees all of that. And as a political matter, let alone as prophecy, but as a political matter, he says, you're blind. Either one must make an accommodation with Bovel. And we see that throughout the history of the Tanakh that the Nevi'im were in favor of accommodations. And basically what we have to do is give up this pagan, idol-oriented lifestyle. We have to give up the assimilation. We have to do what God tells us to do. God will come and save us. He's preserved us till now. And all of his words fall not only on deaf ears. All of his words are translated as sedition and as treason. So that instead of being the potential hero of the Jewish people, he is the villain. He's the worst of them all. And no one enjoys hearing bad news, and no one enjoys hearing bad news from someone whom you feel is not really on your side. And therefore, a great deal of the message of Yirmiyah is discounted by the Jewish people before they even hear it. That's part of the tragedy. I think the greatest tragedy in life is to be right about important matters and to live to see that people didn't listen to you, and because of that, they are destroyed. And if those people are, God forbid, your people, if it's your family, then the pain is worse than anything else because of the fact that it is clear that it could have been avoided if they would have listened to you. They didn't listen to you. Look what happened, and you knew it. And you're powerless to do anything about it. That's the picture of the Novi Yirmiyah. It's not for naught that in all renditions of the prophet that have been painted, and we have no idea what the prophet looked like, but in all the famous paintings of the prophet Jeremiah, the anguish, the sadness of the situation is conveyed. And the anguish and the sadness is not just the destruction of Jerusalem, it's the fact that he predicted it, he knew it, he told them what was going to happen, and they didn't listen. I have a print in my home of the painting of Rembrandt of the prophet Jeremiah. The original oil painting hangs in the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, one of the most magnificent paintings in the world. The entire pathos of the situation just, it leaps at you from the canvas. It's a tremendously powerful painting. So we brought the print home, we framed it. We really liked it. We framed it and put it up on one of the walls in the house. And there was a Jew who came to see me and he asked, "What is that picture?" So I told him, "That's the prophet Jeremiah." He said, "It can't be because he's not wearing a yarmulke." He's right, it's probably not, but our rabbi saw also in Yirmiyah the end of prophecy, even though he's not the last prophet. His own disciple, Baruch ben Neriah, has the gift of prophecy. And then the three prophets in the beginning of the Second Temple, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, and also the prophet Yechezkel, who was somewhat of a contemporary, but who lived longer, later. All of them, the Talmud tells us, their prophecy was already included in Yirmiyah's prophecy. Yirmiyah is the end. And the rabbis say that that's why it says he was from the tribe of Benjamin. The tribe of Benjamin was the last of the tribes, and Yirmiyah is really the last of the prophets. From his time. So one of the insights here is not only is he the last of the prophets, since he was a prophet who was disregarded. So to speak, God gets tired of the charade. What's the use of sending prophets, right? To send prophets that they should throw them in prison, that they should ignore them, that they should pull the hair from his face. I mean, why should we go? That's an exercise in futility. The Jewish people are not interested to hear prophecy. Okay, you don't want it, then you don't need it. That's generally how God works with us. You don't want it, so it's not there. And that's part of the message here, that the prophet Yirmiyah is the last of the prophets. We have from the Yirmiyah, he was a historian of the time. The book of Malachim is written by Yirmiyah, the book of Kings. And we also have the book of Yirmiyah itself and the book of Eicha. The book of Eicha, we will see, was written in stages. part of the book of Eicha was written, and the king Jehoiachin called him in. He heard that the prophet had written a seditious piece of work, and he called him in, and he read it, and he burned it, which is a typical act of a king. And he read, Eicha Yoshva Bodod. So he scratched out the name of God. He saw to it that the name of God didn't appear in it, and he burned it. He threw it on the fireplace, and it burned. Yirmiyahu wrote a second portion of it, which we read, Eicha Yoiv, Eicha Yuam, the other two chapters. And he wrote it again. One of the chapters was written as a description of the death of the king of Yoshiyahu. So the five chapters of Eicha were not written as we imagine at the time of the destruction of the temple. Most of the book was written before. It was written in the prophecy of what is going to be. And that's what makes it even more powerful. Yirmiyahu's unpopularity is really a source of wonderment. His unpopularity is of such a nature that even after the Churban, according to the opinion of the Medrash, he was killed by the Jews themselves. He was killed in Egypt. The Egyptians worshipped the Egyptians when the Churban occurred. So 90% of the Jews went into exile in Babel. About 10% of the Jews went into exile in Egypt. Yirmiyahu went to Egypt because he was afraid of the Babylonians. He had other reasons. He went to Egypt. And there in Egypt, he gained popularity with the Egyptian government, etc. But the Jews were so angry at him that the Jews assassinated him. And I think that's the ultimate Jeremiah possible. The ultimate sadness possible is the fact that that having been correct and having tried to save the people of Israel and having undergone everything at their hands, at the end he dies at their hands, and yet only the Jewish people preserved him. He's been preserved throughout the ages by us. In his time, he was not the only prophet. Our rabbis tell us that Yirmiyahu was the outside prophet, the public prophet, the prophet of the people. Tzvanya, who's mentioned in Treyosor, one of the 12 prophets, he was the prophet to the synagogues, to the yeshivas. And Hulda, who was one of the 7 women who are listed as prophetesses, and she was a relative of the Navi Yirmiyahu. So she prophesied for the women. So the Rabboni Shalom, so to speak, sent a triple header, right, a 3-barrel shotgun to try and get the message across that the Churban is coming, the destruction is here, and Babylonia is the end, and that the Jewish people have to do something. And it was impossible for him to, they didn't get through. After the death of Yoshiyahu, Jehoiakim becomes the king, then Jehoiachin becomes the king, then Tzidkiyahu becomes the king. So he's the king, he is a prophet over a space of 4 different monarchs. All of the kings are well-meaning, but none of them are willing to accept the burden that Yirmiyahu places upon them. And they really feel that he is seditious. And Yirmiyahu comes and says terrible things. Their only response was to mock him. And their response was to be physically violent. And we see that Yirmiyahu himself takes it, you would have to be not only superhuman, you'd have to be who knows what, not to take it personally. Such treatment, such revilement, such problems. There's no way that he can respond to it. And we see the Gemara in Bava Kamma says that Yirmiyahu said, even if the Jewish people do something good, even if they give charity, have them give charity to people who are unworthy. So they don't have the full mitzvah. The bitterness of that statement. Because they're not worthy. That's it. Their behavior is inexcusable. And if we read the Navi, we see that the Navi is correct almost. I mean, we can't make these judgments, but he's correct almost in saying that God is unfair to him. He gave him an impossible task, the risk of his entire life, and he has nothing to show for it. It doesn't help. Yirmiyahu is arrested finally. After having preached and preached and preached, finally the government is so upset with him that they arrest him and they put him in the dungeon. Now there are two dungeons that are mentioned. One dungeon is the Chatzer HaMatara, which you can see today in East Jerusalem. It's not the old city, but it's in East Jerusalem. The Arabs, in their exquisite historical taste and sensitivity, have a banana market in the cave. But that's the cave, the Chatzer HaMatara, that was used as a dungeon. And the back of the dungeon, there was a tunnel that was dug by the King Tzidkiyahu, which was the escape tunnel from Jerusalem. And the tunnel rises, ends about 20 kilometers outside Jerusalem on the way to Jericho. Now, wherever you have something like this, you always have a great Jewish legend, right? So the legend is that if you go there, you know, you get killed. So that has inhibited exploration, let's put it that way. But non-Jews who are not aware of the, or they don't care, have explored the tunnel. And in our time, the archaeologists are working on it, and they're trying to open it. And that tunnel is the ancient tunnel that the King Tzidkiyahu used to make his escape from Jerusalem. The only thing is that the Babylonian army was informed as to where the place, where the tunnel ended, and there he was captured. He and his sons were captured and came to, sons were killed, and he was blinded. But that tunnel is still there. And Yirmiyahu's dungeon is still there. There's a second place where he was put. He was put babur. He was put in a dungeon. That dungeon, according to the Meforshim, that dungeon was water and mud, quicksand, that was meant to kill the person, but to kill him slowly. And in the Tanakh, we read of his ordeal in the dungeon. We read of the fact that the chief chamberlain of the king's court, Jonasson, is the one who informs against him, and who is his main enemy, and who is convinced that Yirmiyahu is only out to destroy the Jewish people, and who probably has personal enmity also. All of this is mixed in. Very hard to say that he was 100% on behalf of the government. And it says in the Tanakh that Yirmiyahu sinks into the lime, into the mud. And Jonasson mocks him. He says, "Put your head down in the mud." He said, "Maybe you'll get a good night's sleep." And the cruelty to the Navi. But the Navi is saved. The black servant comes and lowers a rope and pulls him to freedom. So the Navi survives it. But Yirmiyahu is never the same after that experience, as no one would be. And what happens is that the king's entire attitude changes towards Yirmiyahu. Originally, the king, Yirmiyahu, had an entree to the king. And the king at least could be spoken to. from the moment he's put in the dungeon, then he's treated not only as a political prisoner, he's treated as an enemy of the state. Anything that he has to say is discounted. Anything that he has to say is of no value. And as we'll see, the troubles come as he foretold them, as he predicted them. So one would think that when the troubles start and it fits exactly with the words of his prophecy, so then they would pay heed to the rest of the prophecy. But the process of his being discredited, the process of his destruction is such that nothing can change it now. It's an inexorable fly to the destruction of the Jewish people. There will be no turning back. And he, in turn, is forced into this type of a life of being reviled and insulted and tortured. And yet, we see that Yirmiyahu also has within his prophecy, some of the greatest words of sympathy and of hope for the Jewish people of any of the prophets. And we read, for instance, the Haftorah on Rosh Hashanah, which is taken from the Navi Yirmiyahu, which describes our mother Rachel weeping for her children, which describes the coming redemption, Vishovu Bonim Ligvulam, the Jewish people return. That those words of, they are not said by a person that's a misanthrope. They're not said by someone who is pessimistic, who is negative. And that's the paradox in the Navi. The Navi has great hopes for the Jewish people. He hasn't written them off. Sometimes maybe it is the great hopes that makes us so sad. You know, if somebody's written off, so he's written off. But now I know it's going to be good. So that makes it even more painful to go through this now. When the Churban comes, I just want to share with you two ideas in the Medrash, which again describe for us the Novi and describe the Jewish people and describe what the Churban was. One Medrash is that God said to Yirmiyahu, listen, I'll give you a choice. You want to go with them to Bovel, or I'll go with them to Bovel. And Yirmiyahu is the one that says, and what use is it if I go to Bovel? You go with them to Bovel. If you go with them to Bovel, then you'll save them. What does Chazal mean by that? So, I mean, that's a historic fact. The Jewish people had a choice. You have a choice of taking the Torah and taking the ideals and the beliefs, or trusting in people. The problem with people is that people die. People are mortal. Anything that's built purely on a person alone, and that there's no idea, there's no inspiration, there's no hope, there's no faith left, that's all there is the person. So we've seen many a time that when the person goes, everything goes with it. But a person that is able to inculcate within others that faith, and to give others the strength and the belief, to push others to the end, so then that lives long beyond him. And Yirmiyahu said, I'm not going to Bovel, because then the faith will be in the Novi. We don't want the faith in the Novi. The faith is in the Ribbon Shalom. The Ribbon Shalom will go with the Jewish people to Bovel. The Ribbon Shalom will accomplish it. And we find the same thing by Moshe. Now, one of the reasons that's advanced why Moshe didn't go into Eretz Yisrael is that exact reason. That's the cult of the personality. People would say, oh, Moshe, right? So it's the religion of Moshe. It's not the religion of Moshe. And therefore, you have to live without Moshe. Second thing that the rabbis point out to us is that the Babylonians knew, the Babylonian army and the Nebuchadnezzar, and by the way, the general of the Babylonian army, Nebuzaradan, about whom I will speak in one of the later lectures, he actually converts and becomes a Jew from the event of destroying the Jewish people because of certain things that occurs to him. But one of the things was that Nebuzaradan was ordered by Nebuchadnezzar to see to it that Yirmiyahu should not be harmed. Because since the Jews said he was a collaborator, since the Jews said that he was guilty of seditious behavior, that he was a traitor, so it must be that he was on our side. If he's on our side, then we have to take care of him. There was, in the ancient world at least, there was at least that type of loyalty. And Yirmiyahu does not want to be protected. The words of the rabbis, every group that they took out to kill, so Yirmiyahu went out with them. He did not want to escape the fate of the Jewish people. Until Nebuzaradan called him in and told him, he said, you don't care about yourself, but you got to care about me, right? If something happens to you, I'm going to get killed. I can't let anything happen to you. You're a shofech domim, that's when the Lashon of the Medrash. You're going to spill blood. You're going to spill my blood. I'll be unable to survive it. And therefore, for my sake, you have to see to it that that you are protected. And Yirmiyahu was protected. But he was afraid of the Babylonians. He was in terror of the Babylonians. He did not want to go to Babylonia, and he did not. In the exile, out of all of them, he preferred to go to Egypt and to try and build a Jewish community there. Now, in Jewish legend, we have that Yirmiyahu went to the Moris HaMachpelah. He went to the cave of Machpelah to beg of Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov to try and prevent the Churban. So here you have this insight that even though he had predicted the Churban, and even though he expected the Churban, and he told them it's coming, and even though there's a piece of him, I don't want to say that wants the Churban, but justifies the Churban. When the moment of the Churban is here, he goes to every length to protect, to prevent it. He leaves no stone unturned. He demands that the Jewish people, everybody should stand. And in the kinnus that we have for Tisha B'Av, in the sad poems that are part of the service of Tisha B'Av that have been written over the ages, references are made to all these events. Oz b'haloch Yirmiyahu al kivrei avos. Then when Yirmiyahu went to the Moris HaMachpelah, so the poet describes for us his prayer, how he tried to save the Jewish people and how it was too late. So Yirmiyahu becomes the symbol of that. A great deal of that was in our time too, that there were Jews that, though no one saw it in all of its awful intensity, no one imagined that it would be the way it was. But nevertheless, people saw in advance and warned. And they would have been in a position to say, I told you so. And instead of saying that, they willingly went to share the fate of their brethren. They willingly went back to die with them, and because of the fact that that was part of being a Jew. Rabbi Chonam Wasserman was here in the United States in 1939, and everyone begged him not to return because it was obvious that no matter what happened, it wasn't going to be good, and that the German invasion of Poland was imminent. And he said that he knew that he was going back to his death. He knew he was going back to a terrible fate. But that he could not forsake his community, his yeshiva, his family, those that were those that had supported him and those to whom he was attached. At the beginning of the reign of King Yoshiyahu, when Yirmiyahu began his prophecy, his career. So Yirmiyahu went and gathered the remnants of the 10 tribes. The Gemara teaches us that. The Yalkut Shimoni quotes that. That he went and he gathered the remnants of the 10 tribes and brought them all to Judah. And that under the reign of King Yoshiyahu, they were resettled in Judah and were made whole again. And that at that period of time, therefore, you had at least pieces of all of the 12 tribes living together under one government or near Yerushalayim. He had a solid and unified Jewish people. So his reign began on a high. And Yirmiyahu's prophecy, Yirmiyahu thought that the Churban could be avoided. But the death of Yoshio, as I mentioned before, that's really the death knell of the Jewish kingdom, because all the kings who come after him are going to be unable to even think in those terms. A rabbi say, why did Yoshio, who was such a righteous king, he was such a melech tzaddik, and that he accomplished so much, and he was such a great man, why was he killed in the war? What was his sin? A rabbi saw it as a punishment, not only for Yoshio, but a punishment for the Jewish people. And they said the punishment was because he didn't listen to the Navi. Now that's a trait that you have often, that the Navi is a Navi in spiritual matters, but on political matters, you know, he's not my national security advisor. No reason to listen to Rabbi Shach on matters of defense or security. There's no reasons to listen to you have to listen to the people who are experts in it. Most of the time, the experts are not so expert. If you ever stop to figure out, all the great mistakes in diplomacy and in war have always been made by experts, not by amateurs. And it should give one pause. Generally in life, in certain areas, expertise is not only necessary, it's recognized, and it always works, it's always right. I would rather, have to deal with a surgeon that's an expert than somebody that's an amateur. But in many of the unpredictable areas of life, economics, diplomacy, the social sciences, education, many times the experts are very inexpert. And the things that they predict and the things that they're confident of and the ones and they're sure and they, it turns out to be nothing. And the so-called simple person, the spiritual person, the person with common sense, if one would have listened to him, then things would have turned out much more fortunately. Well, the same thing is here. Our rabbis say Yoshio listened to his experts. His military experts said, oh yeah, we can win this war. This is easy. And his political experts said there will be no fallout. You know, it'll be a quick war with Egypt, in and out. You can just hear the language, because nothing has changed over all the centuries the way people are. And the diplomat said, don't worry, it'll be over before the United Nations even meets. You have no problems. And he didn't ask Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu told him, don't go. So he didn't call you when he decides to go. He doesn't call in Yirmiyahu to debate it with him, to ask him again, shall I go? Should I not go? Is it good? What does God have to say? Nothing. He goes. And that's his undoing. That's his death. And upon him does Yirmiyahu say Yirmiyahu quotes his last words. The last words of the King Yoshio. It's quoted in Eicha as though it's part of Eicha, but it's, the rabbis say, it's the last words of the king. Tzadik hu Hashem ki piu morisi. God is righteous because I did contrary to his commands. I didn't listen to what he told me. They told me not to go and I went. They told me not to make war and I made war. I trusted in myself. And that's the price to pay. And therefore it says, Vayoru Hamorim Lamelech Yoshio. The archers who stood, they shot directly at him and they killed him. And why did he go out in the war? And why did he go on the front line? So that's already the arrogance of kings, even of righteous kings. People who feel they're immortal, and people who feel that they're right, that nothing can happen to them. So they exposed themselves to unnecessary dangers. And here the danger was so clear and blatant and apparent, and he didn't see it, and he was shot dead. The rabbis say that he had 300 wounds or 500 wounds. It was just like a sieve. And that his death, the Navi attributes to the fact that he rebelled against, he not only rebelled against God's word, he didn't even bother to consult. He felt it was unnecessary. He could handle it by himself. And that is, as I mentioned, really the death knell of the Jewish kingdom, of the kingdom of Judah. It's not just the death knell of Yoshio HaMelech. He himself is dead. The Jewish people are dead because of it. And Yirmiyahu is the one that sees it. Final idea regarding the Navi is that in the ideas of hope that we see portrayed in the Navi, the strongest statement of hope has to do, and we read this as a Haftorah also, that when the city was besieged already, and the siege machines were outside the city, and the Babylonians had raised a dike, a large hill. That was the method of investing a city in siege, was to pour large mounds of dirt, and gradually you built up the mounds of dirt till you were as high as the top of the wall, and then you did it till you were higher than the top of the wall, and then you were able to shoot directly into the city. Because originally when they came to the siege, the walls were very high, and the besieging army was low, was at ground level. So it was very difficult, unless you used strong catapults, to really do damage in the city. So the engineering of the time, the military engineering of the time, was to build these tremendous dikes, landfills all around the walls, and from that vantage point, one was able to shoot directly into the city, and they shot fire and boulders and arrows, and they inflicted tremendous damage. So when these dikes were being built, so God tells the Navi that he should buy a piece of property in Anosos, in his hometown. It was a good buy. His uncle wants to sell the piece of property. His uncle, in the right of redemption, Hanamel ben Dodi, and Yirmiyahu is the closest relative, and as we see in the book of Ruth, and generally in the Tanakh and Halacha, relatives have the right, because then it remains within the family, and he buys the property. God told him to do it, and he does it. But when it's all over, he asks the basic question. He said, what's going on here? He said, I don't understand. Aho Hashem Elokim, how can this be, God? You know, the Babylonian army is outside the walls of Jerusalem, and the dikes have already been raised to the level of the city walls, and you have said that the city is going to be destroyed, and the temple is going to be destroyed, and you tell me to buy property in Eretz Yisrael. You tell me it's a good buy, that I should go ahead and do it. And God gives his usual cryptic answer. He said, is anything too wondrous for me? You'll see. So he has already become a partner in the redemption of the Jewish people. In the midst of the destruction of the Jewish people, Yirmiyahu already sees the redemption of the Jewish people. That in his own words, O Jitu Kromim, there will be a day when they will yet plant vineyards again. The end, even though the end is so apparent and it's so startling and it's imminent and it's awful in its intensity, but it's not the end. It's the end of one of the stages of Jewish history, but it's not the end. There never is an end to Jewish history. And therefore he buys the property from his relative. And in buying the property, that affirmation of faith rings down through the centuries. And throughout the centuries, many Jews have imitated Yirmiyahu. Jews always bought property in Eretz Yisrael, even at terrible times. Jews never gave up on the hope of their return to Zion, even in the worst of times. Jews never gave up on themselves. And the Novi Yirmio is the symbol of that hope. He's the symbol of that strength. He did it. And he's the author of the famous verse, Baruch HaGever Asher Yiftach BaHashem Voyo Hashem Miftacho. Blessed is the person who trusts in God, and God is the source of his strength and the source of his trust. Meaning that if one trusts in God, then one is never disappointed. Orer HaGever, cursed is the person that trusts in man, that trusts in his own strength. So it's not cursed that you curse him for it. It's a statement that such a person is cursed because he's doomed to disappointment. The best of intentions, the strongest of people, the wealthiest of institutions, the greatest of causes, all are insufficient in history. Many times it just doesn't happen. Counts on it, he counts on it, he banks on it, it's going to be for sure. Al tiftachu, don't trust in man, trust in God. And that was really the lesson that the Novi Yirmiyahu tried to impress upon the Jewish people. Don't trust in Egypt. Egypt is not going to save you. And that's the lesson that we saw in the Novi Hosea when he said, Ashur lo yoshienu, Ashur is not going to come by to save us. He's not riding on a horse to come and redeem us. None of that is going to happen. And we see, unfortunately, the tendency that exists throughout Jewish history and that exists today also, is that trust is placed, really misplaced trust, in those that if push will come to shove, God forbids, you can't really expect much from them. It won't happen. So you're left to your own devices. You're left to your own self-trust. And self-trust alone is also insufficient. So you have to trust in God. That was the foreign policy of Yirmiyahu. And that foreign policy, it was the foreign policy of all the prophets. The prophets, they preceded George Washington, who warned against foreign alliances and foreign entanglements. It's a negative in Jewish life. It's not a positive. And guaranteed existence, or guaranteed borders, or guaranteed anything by the nations of the world, it all sounds good. But in the perspective of history, it doesn't carry much weight. And that really was the message of Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu tried to point it out to them, that ultimately they have to rely upon God. Well, if ultimately you have to rely upon God, then you got to behave yourself. Then all the nonsense that's going on can't really go on indefinitely. Sooner or later, there is a cost here. God will not forever allow it to happen. And because of that, therefore, he was so unpopular. He said what was true and what they knew deep down in their hearts was true. But like most of the things that we know that is true, if it conflicts with my immediate plans, so then I do terrible things. I remember when I was a lawyer once, I had a client who had to go on vacation. I mean, he had made plans to go on vacation, and he was going away that day. And we were closing a very large real estate deal in the morning. And right before I came to the closing, I saw something in it that I didn't like. He was buying this as an investment property. It had many buildings to it and apartments. And it was a lot of money. And I saw that the rent rolls were not realistic. The rent rolls were inflated. And I told him, I said, I think that the person got the rent rolls to this level because he's giving them 6 months free and they're only paying 6 months. So the rent roll is really, so even though he's showing you checks and a rent roll that it brings in $300,000 a year, I think it only brings in $150,000 a year because for 6 months they're not paying rent. Every time a new tenant comes in, he gives them a 6-month concession on the 1-year lease. So if you're buying at a multiple of the rents, which is the way real estate is usually sold, investment real estate, 5 times the rent, 10 times the rent, whatever, you should buy at times $150,000, not times $300,000. That was Wine the genius that told him that. But he was so committed to go on vacation, because that would mean the whole deal would fall apart, and he had investors and a mortgage, and you know, like everything was in place. And there was months of work involved. And his wife called him up when I was in my office, you know, to find out, because she's burning to go. And when's he coming home? They have to get to the plane. So he bought it, and exactly what it was, right? He only had half the rent roll, and he lost his shirt on it. And he almost went under. He almost went under financially, he almost went under mentally from it. And he knew it. It was such a lesson to me. He knew it, but he was going on vacation. So I always decided that I would close deals when the other guy had to go on vacation. And that's a serious thing. I always say, you know, people say don't go in the hospital the first week in July, right? When everything is changing. Well, you know, if you can get the other guy, if the other guy is going on vacation, or his better still, if his lawyer is going on vacation, and the lawyer wants to, you know, he wants to close the deal, he wants to go, then you have him, right? Then you say, you know, by the way, you know there's we need another $100,000 for the deal to go through, or we don't want to make the prorations based on this, etc. I'm not a lawyer any longer, so God forbid that I should ever use such tactics, but psychologically it's present. And that's what happens here. That's exactly what happens here. They know that Yirmiyah is right, but they're committed already to something. They're all going on vacation, right? They're committed to something else already, and therefore they're not willing to make the instant change which could have saved them and could have changed all of world history. One last point. According to the Medrash, it's not clear, but according to the Medrash and according to the Talmud, Yirmiyah had a son called Ben-Sira. And the famous Ben-Sira, who wrote the Mishlei Ben-Sira, one of the books of the Apocrypha, and who's mentioned very favorably by the Talmud, and was quoted extensively by the Talmud. And the book was very well known, and it's still in existence today. And according to the Medrash, he was conceived by what today we would call artificial insemination. And that story, by the way, is the basis for most of the halachic discussion about the problem of artificial insemination and test tube babies, etc., which in our time has become, almost an everyday occurrence in certain parts of the world, and in certain there are literally factories that produce embryos. But the story is mentioned, and Yirmiyah is the father. How he became the donor, etc. There are all sorts of different midrashim. One is that it was against his will. There are all sorts of stories. But Yirmiyah is the classic case of it. And Ben-Sira was the product of it. And that, to a certain extent, that's why they called him Ben-Sira, because they wanted to hide the relationship. And Yirmiyah comes down to us not through his son, but through his disciple, Baruch Ben-Neriah, who will later be the Rebbe of Ezra Sofer, who's the transmitter of the oral tradition to Ezra and to the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. And it's Baruch who really gives us the picture of Yirmiyah, gives us the picture of his accomplishments and of his life and what occurred, and gives us a portrayal of the times. But Yirmiyah, as I mentioned, is really the last Novi, because all the other Neviim are part of him. He's the last Novi of the Jewish people, and describes the terrible events of the Churban, who was the eyewitness to it. And through his eyes, till today, in the Megillas Eicha, and in his book, and in the Sefer Melachim, through his eyes today, we see the events of that time, and the terrible destruction of the temple, and the historic consequences that came therefrom.
This concludes Lecture 100 on Jeremiah by Rabbi Beryl Wein. For information, please contact the Destiny Foundation at 1-800-499-WINE. That's 1-800-499-9346. We can also be reached by email at info@jewishdestiny.com. Shop online at www.rabbiwine.com. Due to copyright laws, we kindly request that there be no duplication of this lecture.